head with all their lies. Don't you think that there's a reason? Just what do they have to hide with all their lies?
And that was Andy Laufer from the late 70s, Lies. Andy was a singer who was a part of an actual revolutionary group, the Above Ground Support System for the New World Liberation Front, for all you old-timers. That was 22 years ago in San Francisco in the mid-70s. And they were a left-wing revolutionary group, one of the few that I knew about in any direct way. And Andy was a great singer, and we're going to hear a few more of her songs, which didn't get much play. They were never published commercially, but you get to hear them here on Bathrobs Piers Broadsides, 96.3 FM. Now we're going to hear an interview from Sharon Pearson. Sharon is the editor of the Burnside Cadillac, a homeless newspaper in Portland, Oregon. And she's currently in the middle of a campaign to end the sleeping ban in Portland, Oregon, with, well, it's called the Campaign for Legal Places to Sleep, and we'll hear her talk about that next.
It's the 6th of August. We're on the line with Burnside Cadillac editor and publisher Sharon Pearson. Hi, Sharon.
Hey.
And Sharon, you're up in Portland, Oregon.
Yes.
You have been working on this. This is a homeless publication. Why is it called the Burnside Cadillac, for those who don't know?
Oh, it's a euphemism for shopping cart. I think in California, you guys call them the California Cadillac?
Possibly. we can find them around before they take us in.
Yeah. They arrest you for having them.
In some places, yeah. Actually, I saw a guy who was directed to get rid of his shopping cart on the mall 3 days ago.
Well, we have a lot of that here. Yeah. Did you read that the Catholic worker bought 100 of those and handed them out to homeless people in, I think it was Seattle, and the police were really alarmed, and they said, oh no, they're going to use them as stepladders to climb into, break into buildings.
And probably rollerblades to rush down the street and race each other. Yeah, they did this. There was some similar situation happening in San Francisco, although I don't know if the shopping carts ever got out. Some supervisor in San Francisco wanted to stop the shopping cart menace, and then ended up getting embarrassed and saying, oh no, I was just looking into how it could be facilitated when some large charity was offering to buy a bunch of old shopping carts. I think Safeway actually volunteered to donate them. But anyway, the Burnside Cadillac is the name of your publication. How long have you been publishing, and what is this publication?
Well, it's a 12-page tabloid that is admittedly biased. We state it in our mission statement that, you know, we're just writing about poverty and homeless people. 50% of it has to be written by homeless people. It started out in 1989 as a newsletter for a literacy project that we were running here, but in 1995, I think it was, that we turned it into a newspaper, and we've been selling it now for 2 years, and so homeless people sell it on the sidewalks.
And this is in Portland, Oregon, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in Portland, what's the population of Portland?
I don't know.
No.
No, I used to know, but you know, I just don't keep track of that anymore because, I mean, of course, population data is probably accurate, but
hundreds of thousands, or
well, probably I would say, well, when you talk about Portland, you're talking about Multnomah County.
Uh-huh. It's the largest city in Oregon. Right?
Yeah, and it's probably 800,000.
And so, of those, how many would you estimate are homeless?
Gosh, I hate it when people ask.
I know, me too.
You mean a percentage?
Yeah. Or how many people?
Oh, I would say maybe between 5 and 7%.
Wow. So that's a pretty high percentage. Is that been standard for the last decade, do you think? Or?
No. I think since 89, well, you know, if I just take a random sample, which is the sample of population that I work with, which is downtown homeless, we saw a 50% increase between January and April, January being the first time that the welfare reform cuts were felt. Mm-hmm. Just in those months, there was a 50% increase in people downtown.
We're talking about this year, 1998?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. January, this last January.
And this is the same time when Portland has a climate, pretty rainy area, right?
Yeah, it's really cold. You know, there are shelters. We don't have, like any other city, we don't have enough shelter space, but the shelter space that we do have is pretty typical. You know, it's crowded, it's smelly, people get body lice really fast. And we have, I don't know, compared to other cities or not, but we have quite a large population of homeless, mainly males, who won't use the shelters anyway. Mm-hmm. And that's primarily the folks that we see on a regular basis. You know, they're the campers, they're the people that want to, you know, camp out under the bridges and so on and so forth. And, you know, the other thing about the shelters is that you're institutionalized. Same thing goes, you know, I think, with low-income housing. You know, Ruben Botello said it very well, that the system, you know, reaches out and it pulls in the cream of poor people that it can control, manage, and profit from. And those who are not in the system are criminals. You can hurt those people by putting them in jail and prisons.
I think that's very well put here. Chris, quoting a man who runs probably the only really widespread homeless news service in the country, is an internet activist from Eureka who was also instrumental in helping organize protests against the sellout and deportation of the Eureka homeless last fall.
Yes, and he writes for our paper as well as provides us with our news service, and, you know, has been played a very integral part of our success in our campaign. He has an ability to succinctly describe what's going on, you know, tell it like it is. I think I have the same ability, but I think that he really can do it well. We're experiencing, since we started the campaign for legal places to sleep, which, by the way, is saying to the city, get rid of this ordinance that arrests people for sleeping outside of the system. In other words, on the sidewalks, under bridges. And saying to them that once we turn our materials in, which will be the end of August, stop arrest. We'll give you 30 days to stop arresting. But in addition to that, we're saying we want campsites. We have homeless people that are not going to go into shelters. They're not going to get into low-income housing. And we've identified, we've worked with some a couple groups from out of town. And we now have identified that we want what are called alternative lifestyle camps. And we want to do this on a trial basis for 1 year. We want 20 people at each camp. One camp would be youth, one would be mentally challenged, one would be families, one would be clean and sober, and one would be what we call wet. And this means people who drink, not people who use drugs.
Mm-hmm. I guess the drug camp must await the next millennium.
Well, you know, we're telling them that making demands on them, and I just don't think that we can stand up right now and say that we want a druggie camp. You know, I just don't know. Might be kind of hard, but we might do it next year.
Refreshing to hear. So Portland has a practice of, sweeping the bridges regularly or only sort of seasonally?
We've got a weird situation here. I mean, at least I think it's weird. Maybe your listeners will say, we got the same thing. But, you know, they're in the world of nonprofits. You know, you have service providers, and then you sometimes have a nonprofit organization who says they advocate for homeless people.
Yeah.
Well, we have one here, and what they do is they actually work with the police. So the police call them up and they say, we're going to sweep under the Burnside Bridge. And these fools, they just scatter around and they go under the bridge and they actually clean it up. You know, maybe they get one or two homeless people to clean it up for them, you know, and thereby avert the cops going in sometimes.
Hmm.
But, for example, when we started our campaign in April, this group approached us and said, Part April said, we've got some inside information. The cops are going to do a huge sweep under all the bridges the 18th of April.
Uh-huh.
And so we want to let your group know so that, you know, we can all get out there and protest, blah, blah, blah. And I didn't buy it.
Uh-huh.
I figured it was something wasn't right. You know, police don't leak information like that. So we didn't do it, and what they did is they went under the bridges on the 10th, which is what I think they had planned all along. They went under them at 2:30 in the morning in driving rain, and I know from people I've talked to that under the Burnside Bridge, four cops went under there, and two of them were just kicking people, you know, kicking them right in their sleeping bags. And they'll go in and they'll trash camps and throw the stuff in the Willamette River and then blame it on homeless people.
Wow.
And one night we were doing some interviewing on the streets and somebody ran up and said, you got to get down to First Avenue because the cops are down there smashing up a camp. Well, we got down there after they did it, and this woman had a large camp with everything in its place, you know, just she had pallets and little walls, and she had milk cartons with her vegetables, cans of vegetables in there. We took the picture and we printed it in the paper. So then somebody in the community could be driving along and see that and naturally come to the conclusion that a homeless person did this, left it this way.
When in fact, as is often the case, certainly was the case in Santa Cruz in 1988 when the police raided the Paso Tiempo area, and then we went in later ourselves and cleaned it up with the homeless people who were there as one of these futile goodwill gestures that I've since learned is really kind of pointless.
Yeah, it is.
It's sort of like, you know, bowing and shucking if you're a black guy and hoping that that's going to make everybody give you equal rights. It doesn't really work that way.
Exactly. It's, you know, I think a lot of the strategies that a lot of us have tried for a long, long time don't work anymore.
So what's your new strategy in Portland? Tell us more about this campaign for legal places to sleep.
Well, one thing that might interest you or might interest people who like to organize or have experience organizing and was that, you know, my background was sociology, community organizing, and the typical way of organizing for social change is to go out and get a bunch of people and you come in and you start talking to people and developing strategies and your mission statement, and then you do cooperative efforts, you know, you link up. Coalition building is the term.
Uh-huh.
I have learned to gag on.
Yes, yes.
You go out and you build coalitions.
I'm falling asleep here, yeah.
So that you can make social change. Well, what that results in, as you probably know, Robert, is that you end up working on your group dynamics, on your internals. You know?
Uh-huh.
Trying to get your people to bond and agree and all this happy stuff. And in the meantime, you don't do anything.
Nope.
So with this campaign, I didn't do that. I didn't bring people together for any meetings. We just started going out and getting the signatures, and that's where the group cohesiveness came in the doing.
And how many signatures have you gotten so far?
We've got about 9,000.
And how many people would you say are active in this campaign?
I would say maybe 15 to 20. Maybe 15. No, I'd say closer to 15.
And
We kept it small. We resisted linking up with other groups, even though they wanted us to and were really pressuring us to. And then just 2 weeks ago, we started opening it up and saying it's open now for anybody that wants to come in. Because we, you know, and what the reason for this is that we were solid within ourselves. You know, small is manageable. So we were, as a group, we were really tight. We've been together a long time. We knew what we were doing. We opened it up. New people came in. Then everyone can assist new people and tell them what's going on. And instead of them looking toward the leader, the president or whomever.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the things that the system likes to do is, you know, chop off the head, go after the leader.
And everybody runs around thinking it's all over.
Yeah, and so I didn't want my head chopped.
Certainly not.
And I didn't want anything to happen to the campaign. And we've met, the community of Portland has been overwhelmingly supportive of this campaign.
How about the Portland City Council, dare I ask?
Didn't say a word to them, but Ruben organized a small email letter writing campaign to our mayor.
I remember, I wrote one.
That's right. And when you read her response, you know, which I thought was a wonderful strategy, you know, because I like the teachings of Saul Alinsky, and he used to say, never go outside the experience of your group, but always go outside the experience of your enemy. So in other words, never do what they think you're going to do. Right? So our mayor was getting letters about our campaign from people that didn't even live here.
And was there any response other than groans and silence?
From her?
Yeah, or from the council?
Well, the only thing I saw was from her and a letter that she put out.
I saw that letter.
No, we haven't done it, you know, we were not interested in negotiating and talking with them or doing anything until we're ready to lay it on their lap.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the attitude is they work for us. You know, there's no reason to go and do obeisance to them.
Mm-hmm.
And we did, Kaya, one of our reporters last month, did sort of try to get an interview with Jim Francesconi on the council and never got it. Got a, you know, some blanket statement from one of his aides. And so that was our first real, it was sort of like testing the waters. That's all we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing what the reaction was going to be. Could we even get it? As a newspaper, get an interview. You know, if we'd been the Oregonian, we would have gotten right in.
Now, your vendors, how many vendors would you say sell the Burnside Cadillac?
Many. Not many anymore. this program isn't working so good.
Hmm. But would you say that, are the vendors that do sell it harassed by police?
No, we had that problem when we started out.
Mm-hmm.
We were harassed by police and we were harassed by security guards.
Mm-hmm.
But early on, at Christmas time, I had sent out a volunteer to go see the mayor and get a letter of support, and I don't think she even knew what she signed, and we stuck that on the front of the paper.
And so then she was...
stuck.
She was stuck with supporting the vendor program.
Well, that's what it looked like, you know, and so when we started having trouble, we just called her office, and... But also, you know, a lot of the security guards and the cops started really liking what we were doing, to tell you the truth. There are some good folks here.
Mm-hmm.
And, the biggest problem that we have is making any money. You know, I'm the only full-time staff,
mm-hmm.
and I haven't been getting a salary for months. And it's very hard to run a campaign and run a newspaper and, you know, recruit your vendors and get some advertising and do all of that. So that's our predicament, our only predicament.
Yeah, well, it's strange. You know, even as we're talking, there's a newspaper conference in Montreal by bunches of street newspapers, and the problem is that the small papers with integrity, who are close to the homeless, have all kinds of trouble just surviving. And the folks who have gotten good at the business have forgotten what it means to be homeless and are, you know, essentially selling out homeless people. So it's kind of it's a really sad scene. It's really hard to tell what to do in this circumstance.
Well, you know, I think that it's just symbolic of how it has always been. You know, every movement, it's, you know, the need for money. But what I've learned as an organizer is, you know, and I've said to people, if my focus had been on money, we would have money. But when your focus is on being with people,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the real world, and sitting and listening and holding somebody's hand or hauling somebody's stuff for them, or, you know, the real day-to-day things that you do with people who are in danger and who are suffering, that doesn't leave you a lot of time to hustle bucks.
We're talking to Sharon Pearson of the street paper in Portland, Oregon, Burnside Cadillac. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz. And Sharon, in Eugene, about a year ago, the Eugene City Council, rather unexpectedly, I guess on the eve of a civil disobedience training by some of the homeless activists there, set up a trial, I guess you would call it, safe zone for homeless people in vehicles. Do you have any comments on that? Any?
Well, actually, you know, our campaign is called the Campaign for Legal Places to Sleep.
Uh-huh.
The acronym is CLPS. And that's the same name of that campaign in Eugene. So when I started the campaign, they assisted what I was trying to do here. The only difference between the two, of course, was our wanting campgrounds, not safe zones for people in cars. They're struggling down there. Charles Gray is one of the founders of that whole, in fact, he named it Campaign for Legal.
Actually, Charles Gray came from Santa Cruz in 1988, where he was arrested for illegal sleeping right by my side and at the town clock.
He's great. He stayed at my apartment. You know, we had a in corporate dominance seminar in Portland. That was the first seminar like it I've seen since the 60s. It was just outrageously good. But anyway, in June, you know, that ordinance was approved for 1 year. What it did is it allowed people to sleep on private property in their cars with permission from the owner on public property like churches in their cars with permission from the owner. And then to have a campground in your cars in the industrial zone. So evidently it took the business sector by surprise, and so they've had a year to organize as well. So
I heard today from Tom Musselwhite, Sharon, who's the editor of the Eugene homeless paper Ecos, that there is some city council vote tonight.
Yeah.
Do you have any news for us on that?
No, not on what's going on tonight, but you know, there was a shooting in the camp. It was on the front page of the Eugene Register.
And they're going to use this as an excuse to close down the industrial zone?
Yeah. There's a wonderful quote from a homeless guy, and he said, you know, if there's a shooting in a neighborhood, you know, housed inside of a house, they don't close down the neighborhood. But if we have a problem here, they'll shut the whole camp down. And when I talked to Charles, he said, it didn't look good, but for the industrial zone. It looked like they might lose that whole thing, but they would still have an ordinance that allowed people to sleep in their cars on private property with permission, public property.
It's like saying you're going to repeal the vote for blacks if one person shoots another. I mean, it's amazing. Just how bigotry and ancient stereotypes can just rear up at you.
Mm-hmm. We're doing a story on the front page for August. We went down and interviewed street youth. Mm-hmm. And one of the young people, not knowing what this man had said in Eugene, said the same thing. You know, he said that because, first of all, the biggest complaint is our trash, but when we go to our spots, we don't have any place to put the trash. But if one of us does something wrong, we're all blamed for it.
Yeah, that's the way it is here in Santa Cruz. Sharon, I appreciate you taking this time to talk to me. Is there anything you want to leave us with? I'm running kind of crazy today because of three things I have to do at once. But
Yes, Ward Churchill from AIM made this comment, I'll paraphrase very quickly, at the corporate dominance seminar. And he said, a lot of us that are wanting justice and wanting a major social change in this country are running around looking for some sort of an umbrella fix, you know, whether it be a NASNA like you were talking about, or communism or socialism or whatever. And he said, we're probably not going to find it. But to act locally, each person, you know, step out and do what you can with what is presented to you, and thereby we will all create critical mass. And that's what I believe the 90s is about now, creating that critical mass in all these cities, everywhere we can.
And not getting clubbed as you bicycle through San Francisco, I might add. That's the name of the organization that every month rides through San Francisco on its bikes, called Critical Mass.
Yeah, we've had them up here too. But, you know, I don't think that any social change ever happens without somebody getting a few dents in their skull.
That's probably true. Sharon, thank you for taking the time to talk to us. We'll get back to you when we got more time.
You're welcome.
Denied. people and students. A student sees a street person going through forms, pretending to be crazy, making up impressive jail stories, living off government money with no homework, no pressure, cheating everyone, and with all that money and all that free time and such bizarre costumes, why, he can get more girls than I can. It's an outrage. A street dude sees a student going through ritual classes, pretending to study, making up impressive football stories, living off family money, with no hassle, no need to hustle, cheating everyone, and with all that money and all that free time and such fashionable clothes, well, he can get more girls than I can, and it's an outrage. So the students call street people bums, and the street people call students robots, and the girls walk by, full of promises, saying nothing and proving everything. Kaddish for Martin Horowitz. It's rained since you died, and I hated being out in the rain more than I hated your being dead, because I was getting wet. Everything continues as always. I continue as always, dammit. When something's funny, I laugh. And I'm not sure whether to be relieved or outraged or both. And I feel selfish. I want you back for my sake, not yours. You were someone to talk to who could empathize without listening and always say the right thing in emergencies and the wrong thing the rest of the time so I could be right and bright and silly. Who could look like a cartoon of a New York Jewish mad scientist and then be a New York Jewish mad scientist. Who collected pythons and used to collect guns till some nut acquired one from you to shoot his girl and you got life. Except they let you out because you were going to die within the year, and then you didn't, and they were no end irritated. And some professor wrote a letter recommending you as an original researcher and said the girl had been in his class, and she was so dumb he would have shot her himself if only he'd thought of it first. Who went around the world 4 times to let the snakes loose in the rice paddies to catch rats and explain yourself to the customs officials? Who was born blind and kept night blindness and could read only by taking off your bottle-rimmed glasses and touching the print with your nose? Who survived 2 plane crashes, 1 car crash, assorted fires, and 7 years of marriage? Who was on a guilt trip that meant opening all conversations by informing your helpless listeners you'd worked on the Manhattan Project and what about it? Who was a snob in all directions, despising street people and detesting academia and lecturing yourself and wearing a giveaway suit but never a tie? You wanted your neutrinos back from the sun. You took such things personally. A neutrino has only spin and travels at the speed of light, passing through walls with the greatest of ease, and so do you now. Who had an affair with a witch without a navel and a dyke who could beat you up, and a red-haired smack freak you tried to cure and get supplies for, more or less at once. She's dead now, too. Who was disastrous and irreplaceable? It's been a month by now, and I still have to tell unexpected people and watch their faces fall off and see what their masks will look like in 20 years. Will always like my war poems best and argue I'm not a pacifist and tell me the hard-boiled egg I just bought is raw, and I throw it at you to prove it isn't, and it is because you palmed it. You're all over egg yolk, but so pleased you proved your point and won't let me forget it. Well, I still go on being a pacifist, but who will slip me raw eggs now? I'm not used to being emotional and or dead all over the stage, but there's a hole in the air where once there was a man. And Marty, what the hell? Is this your idea of a joke?
There's a sunny little country south of Mexico, where the winds are gentle and the waters flow. The breezes are the only things that blow in Hillsboro. If you took the little lady for a moonlight drive, odds are still good you'd come back to life. But everyone is innocent until they're right in Hillsboro. The rebels take a bus on the Grand Highway. is asking for continuity. Food and medicine and the means for us. There's a pump, a rumble in the building swing. A soldier fires the acid spray. The public address system starts to blaze out of the morning. You run for cover and hide your eyes. You hear the scream for paradise. They call it better than you realize it is. Out of the just like Poland is protected by her Russian friends, Putin is assisted by America, and if $60 million seems too much to spend in El Salvador, they say for half a billion they could do it right. Bomb all day and burn all night until there's not a living thing upright in El Salvador. They'll continue training troops in the USA and watch the guns that guard the way and teach the military bands to play south of the border and kill the people to set them free. Who put this price on their liberty? Don't you think it's time to leave El Salvador?
Peter, Paul, and Mary from their mid-80s album No Easy Walk to Freedom. The last song was El Salvador, the one before it, Light One Candle, and the poet you heard between those songs, my favorite Julia Vinograd, and her book and audio album, Eye of the Hand. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, micro-broadcasting power in Santa Cruz, the one station that is open to the public. We're currently under threat of FCC thuggery, and we would appreciate your help. If you like what you're hearing on the station and you want to support it, give a call to the voicemail at 427-4523 and tell us so and ask us how you can help, and we'll let you know. We can use money, we can use signatures on a petition, we can use your support in many ways. If you have a program you're interested in putting on the air, we're interested in making the airwaves accessible to you. If you have information the public needs to know about, we want to put it out. Again, the voicemail number, 427-4523. That goes for all programs on this station and all programmers. But if you have a particular interest in what you've been hearing on my show, Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides, and I'm your host, Robert Norris, you can call me at 423-HUFF, 423-4833, and you can leave a message of any length, letting me know what you think of the show, giving me any reactions, passing on any information you think that will be of use to folks who are hearing the kind of information you're getting on the show. Well, a couple weeks ago, I picked up the Anderson Valley Advertiser, which probably some of you listeners know about already. It's a weekly out of Mendocino County, which has got some very interesting stories, some of which I agree with, some of which I don't. The Anderson Valley Advertiser is very bad on homeless issues usually, which is kind of ironic. But on issues of police misconduct, it's right up there on the front lines. And I was reading you a story by Mark Hyman, which I didn't have time to finish, called Mental Health's Death Squad. This was in the July 22, 1998 issue of the Anderson Valley Advertiser, concerned the killing of a Ukiah man named Marvin Noble. And I'm going to pick up reading that story, kind of where I left off. I'm going to sort of summarize what I'd said by beginning with the first paragraph and then kind of skimming and reading it. It's relevant to us because we've had several shootings by the police here in the Santa Cruz area, shootings that are fundamentally unresolved, which have a very suspicious aspect, and which concern poor people, lower income people, people often given a mentally ill or developmentally disabled label. I'm talking about Happy John Dine, I'm talking about Brian Andrus. And it's important that we realize that this is a pattern of behavior not unique to our police department, and the kind of cover-up that follows it is not unique to our police department and our Citizens Police Review Board and our city council. Let's hear about the case of Marvin Noble up in Ukiah. Beginning with the story by Mark Hyman, a Ukiah man with a long history of mental illness was shot and killed by a Ukiah police officer Thursday afternoon. That was presumably in mid-July. The events leading up to the death of Marvin Noble, age 45, were witnessed by dozens of people along busy South State Street, many of whom had known Noble for years. Witnesses say Noble's killing at the hands of the Ukiah PD was unjustified and that the police officers involved caused the confrontation between them and Noble to escalate to lethal force. Underlying the eyewitness accounts was an often expressed fear of the Ukiah Police Department, bolstered by police officer investigators' insistence that witnesses not talk to anyone about what they saw that day. Marvin Noble, a 45-year-old black man from Ukiah, was shot and killed by Ukiah police who had been directed to bring him in for a psychiatric evaluation by Mendocino County Mental Health. Noble had a long history of mental illness dating back to a 1981 incident in which he reportedly raped his ex-wife and threatened her and, his two children with a sawed-off shotgun. He was found guilty by reason of insanity and confined for 4 years to a Atascadero State Mental Hospital. However, there were no violent incidents since that time. And now I'm going to skip ahead because I have read much of this story before. And for those of you who are interested, the Anderson Valley Advertiser can be purchased at the Book Loft, which is a bookstore right next to the Rio Theater at Soquel and Seabright in Santa Cruz, and they still have copies of this issue if you find this story one you want to read further or study more deeply. And I'm going to turn now to the part of the story that I haven't yet read on the air, as far as I know. The bare facts of Marvin Noble's death at the hands of Ukiah police raise many troubling questions, not the least of which is why are police investigators telling civilian witnesses not to talk to anyone about what they saw that day? Marvin Noble had committed no crime, was not wanted on any warrant, was not doing anything more threatening or decompensating than having a soft drink at Foster Freeze on South State Street when Ukiah police appeared and slapped a felony arrest procedure on him. Now, because I'm skipping a large part of this article, and it may seem a little elliptical, I'm going to briefly skip to a story about the question of Marvin Noble in a brief letter. It's actually a comment in a letter which will kind of summarize the perspective of folks looking at this situation from the outside and give us a kind of a quick summary of what it's all about without reading through this extensive story again. Of course, I have to get my papers straight, which is always a problem here. Who really killed Marvin Noble? Here's a letter to the editor from Catherine Houston. Marvin Noble died because of someone's stupidity and carelessness, and that someone isn't in the Ukiah Police Department. Once again, our county mental health department is responsible for the death of a person they were supposed to help, and I, for one, am deeply saddened and really angry. I was Marvin's public defender attorney for nearly 12 years until Jeff Tama took over the office and reassigned Marvin's case. Since Marvin never missed a court appearance with me, I wonder why mental health didn't just wait until Friday when he came to court to talk with him. Why did they want him picked up by the police anyway? I'm not aware of them ever needing to do so before. Police Chief Williams stated it is rare that officers are asked to do such a thing. Why wasn't someone from mental health present at the Foster Freeze to talk with Marvin if it was so important that he be contacted the day before his court appearance? And why didn't someone from mental health tell the police a little more about Marvin's illness so they wouldn't end up in a violent and unnecessary confrontation? Confidentiality? How hypocritical. The court file is a public record and contains Mental Health's own evaluation of Marvin over the years, as well as records from the state hospitals. So the newspaper is allowed to find out what Mental Health had to say about Marvin's criminal history and illness after the fact, but not the police before they contact him. Ha! Huh, someone is full of it. And Marvin, my friend, is dead. He died in fear in the middle of a beautiful sunny day after being attacked by a police dog and shot while on the stairs of his apartment. He died because he chose not to be detained by the police while he was sitting in foster freeze drinking a lemonade, for God's sake. None of this needed to happen. I don't blame Officer Kaser or his canine partner, but somewhere in the investigation of this incident, someone needs to ask why the police were sent to do Mental Health's dirty work, and why no one from Mental Health bothered to explain to them what it was all about, and why no one was able to explain to Marvin what the problem was in the first place. I will miss Marvin. We had some great conversations, some interesting court hearings, and a good attorney-client relationship. He kept in touch with me the entire time I represented him, and because his files were thick with years of psychiatric reports, I felt I knew Marvin better than I knew most clients. I waved to him on the street as I drove by. I spoke with him when I encountered him downtown. Marvin was a great walker as well as a great eater, and was known to everyone in town as he went about his daily rounds, wearing his trademark shorts and plaid shirts. I am not aware of his ever being arrested for anything since his original offense in 1981. He was not a drug or alcohol abuser. He was not known to get into street fights. No wonder the officers weren't familiar with Marvin and his mental illness. He had never posed a problem to law enforcement in all the years he had been a mental health outpatient. I wasn't there when it all happened, but someone let Marvin down. It seems his reactions were defensive, not offensive. It seems he was trying to avoid the police by going home. Why didn't the police call Mental Health or someone with psychiatric training to the foster freeze? Why wasn't someone he knew sent to talk with him instead of strangers in uniform? It worked once when Henry Nelson was his public defender. I would have been there in a flash if I'd known about it, and maybe Marvin would still be alive today. So why is Marvin dead? I sincerely hope the investigations into his killing will provide the answers. Maybe the grand jury will take another look at Mental Health's policies. Maybe the police department will review their procedures on dealing with the mentally ill. Hopefully Officer Kaser and his dog Ido will recover from this traumatic incident. Unfortunately, Marvin won't, and neither will I until the public learns the truth behind what really happened last Thursday and who is responsible for it. Sorry, Mr. Wolf, but your statement to the press that there is no blame in this incident was at best premature and at worst wrong. People who cared about Marvin Noble want answers. Sincerely, Catherine Houston, Ukiah. And here's a second letter from Stephen K. Gill of Garberville. Again, we're reading from the Anderson Valley Advertiser, July 22nd. It is error alone which needs the support of government. Truth can stand by itself. Thomas Jefferson, Notes on Virginia. Now let me get this straight. Some mentally disturbed guy is supposed to be picked up by the cops, reorders of mental health. In the process, the guy is chased around town and draws a knife. Finally, after pepper spray doesn't work, they sick the dog on him. He naturally stabs the dog, wouldn't you? So they shoot him dead. Seems to me that three alert men could have one or two distract him while the other knocks him down from behind. There's so many creative ways they could have taken him down without shooting him. Don't tell me, let me guess. It was a person of color. I once saw a cartoon captioned PC Police, and the police in the car were calling to a guy with a gun in the house, "Come out with your hands up or we'll go on a hunger strike." That might have worked better in this case. You know, the guy's mentally disturbed. It's time to call in the crisis counselor or a therapist. If you were flipped out, would you believe the promises of three big guys with guns? Not me, especially after hearing about so many incidents like this. Another black eye for Mendocino County. What else is new? Stephen K. Gill. This sounds very much, of course, like the Charles Vaughn case in Monterey County, where a man on a roof in Seaside was shot dead by police on the street as he allegedly wielded a corkscrew as police approached him on the roof. It's just incredible. I'm going to continue reading this Mark Hyman story, which goes into it in more detail, and I apologize if it seems a little choppy here. I also want to remind those of you who are hungry that at this very moment, Food Not Bombs is set.